Dave Malarkey's up next with It's Your Turn.
And now, it's your turn with Dave Malarkey. 724-283-2525. It's Butler County's only live call-in talk show. It's Your Turn. Weekdays from 12:30 to 2 on 680 AM WISR and worldwide on the internet at WISR680.com. It's Your Turn. 724-283-2525. And now, it's your turn with Dave Malarkey.
Welcome. It's the Monday edition of It's Your Turn here on WISR. Nice to have you with us. Coming up later on the program today, we're going to be talking about some items that are made in Guatemala, and they're being sold here in Butler County. It's an interesting story to tell. We'll have several guests here to chat with us about it. Has to do with the free trade stuff. And we have some other guests, too, but our first guest is waiting to join us on the telephone right now. He is Matthew Kramer, the musical director and conductor of the Butler County Symphony Orchestra. Matthew, good to talk with you again. Nice to have you back with us.
Always a pleasure to join you, Dave.
I can't believe it's time for another concert. It just seems like yesterday we were gearing up for the opening of the new season, but the second concert is this coming weekend, right?
That's right. We had an incredible opening concert. The orchestra, I could not have been happier with the way that they performed, the energy and passion which they obviously exhibit. Every program, I think, was even highlighted in a much greater fashion. The Bernstein and Barber program was a really great start for us, and now we're off to something that's immensely popular with audiences of all ages.
The Magical Music of Harry Potter is the title of the concert coming up this Saturday night. November 3rd. Boy, that's hard to believe, isn't it? November 3rd, this coming Saturday. So we're talking about music from the films, I guess, right, Matthew Kramer?
That's right. The 8 total films all together. Of course, music is, as we know, is such an important part of the cinematic experience that it's no surprise that the Harry Potter films utilized the work of several prominent composers to underscore all of the drama. And there's just a wealth of material to choose from, so it really was kind of a challenge to take 8 separate films and figure out what portions of the movies we're going to perform in concert. But I think we've got a great mixture of all sorts of music representing all 8 films.
I have a terrible confession to make. I have not seen any of the films in their entirety. I've seen pieces of them here and there as they pop up on TV, but I've never watched one of the films the whole way through. So
there's still time before the concert on Saturday. Dave, you can get caught up on all of the books and all the movies.
I guess I could. I know that at least early on, back when we didn't know that there were going to be 8 films, or 8 books for that matter, the legendary John Williams was the original composer, was he not?
That's right. Of course, any film franchise would love nothing more than to have John Williams score a movie for them. Of course, this is the composer that we performed regularly at the Butler County Symphony, and really orchestras around the world do. He's now well into his 80s, and he's still working hard. He's scoring the Star Wars, the latest Star Wars movies as well, but he masterful, and no surprise, obviously, the way that he created this world of Harry Potter through music. So even hearing a couple of the themes just plucked out on a keyboard, you know immediately what movie this is. The sound of the celesta, which Tchaikovsky used so effectively in The Nutcracker. Well, John Williams composed the opening of the very first Harry Potter film, Hedwig's Theme, it's called, with the use of the celesta, and this wonderful little waltz-like melody has just become iconically tied to the film series. So John Williams responsible for the first 3 movies in the Harry Potter series, and there was never any intention of him staying on for the whole series itself, but he did pass off those themes that he created to a succession of several other composers that followed, and really each film after The Prisoner of Azkaban had a different composer tied along with that. But John Williams, just masterful in the way that he's able to create these worlds you know, in the cinematic experience.
It's hard to believe. I was looking up the dates. The first Harry Potter film was in 01. That's 17 years ago. And, of course, the book came out a year or so before the film. So hard to believe it's been that long ago. We have kids who were 8, 9, 10 years old when the first Harry Potter book came out. They're in their 30s now, for goodness sakes.
Wow. That's right. And what really is so fascinating about this, I was already, I was in my master's degree when the first film came out. But what was so interesting about this is that you did actually see these children actors grow into adults right before your eyes over the course of 10 years. They had it all planned from the very beginning that this was going to be a huge global phenomenon. Obviously, the books, you know, very few things have ever happened in modern literary world that have created the kind of sensation that the Harry Potter books have. And I think it's thrilling to be able to see children and adults line up at bookstores for the latest release. You don't see that very often anymore. And obviously the movies did the very same thing. Daniel Radcliffe and the entire cast were just tiny when the very first film came out. And now they're adults making films, various films nowadays. But, you know, really the whole thing just kind of happened over the course of 10 years. You saw this evolution, not only in the aging of the actors, but the styles of the movie. Chris Columbus directed the first two, and that had a very unique kind of feel to it. And then the movies got a little bit darker as the plot got much more ominous. And it's just fascinating to come back to it. I never really watched much of the films, but I've seen them all at some point or another to appreciate how they were put together, the acting, and, of course, the music.
Yeah, Radcliffe has even done live stage work. He did a revival of Equus on Broadway not too long ago.
You're right.
John Williams, you say he's well up in his 80s now, Matthew?
Oh, yeah, he celebrated his 80th birthday a few years ago, and he's still, what I find so interesting, not only is he composing still film scores, but he's been very active in the last few years of traveling to orchestras around the country here and conducting his music as a fundraiser for those orchestras. Last season, he appeared with the Indianapolis Symphony. He did not take a fee. He returned it to the orchestra, and there you have it. It's just fascinating that he is such an advocate for orchestral music. He makes his music available for purchase, which is very rare because obviously we perform this music so often that if we had to rent it, like we do with most composers, the copyright laws, usually it's about 100 years before it's made to the general public. But John Williams makes his music available for purchase. That way you can perform it as much as you like. He's not in it for the money, obviously. He's the biggest name that we have, and God willing, we'll have him a little while longer. Unfortunately, he fell ill. It was just in the news here a couple days ago that he had to cancel a concert with the Vienna Philharmonic, which was going to be a huge opportunity for promoting his film music in Europe. And we're hoping that he has a very speedy recovery, but when you're well into your 80s, you know, we do have to appreciate that he's probably slowing down, but at least to this point, he shows no sign of it.
He's no longer associated with the Boston Pops, is he?
No, but that's great that you mentioned that because that was really a phenomenal period for Pops music in this country. And it's interesting to note that every conductor for the Pops, Boston Pops, has had their own stamp on it. Arthur Fiedler, obviously, his stamp was to make the light classics popular and really kind of ubiquitously performed in the United States, the Leroy Anderson miniature pieces, the 1812 Overture Light Cavalry. When John Williams came aboard the Boston Pops, 86 years old John Williams is, thanks to the internet, he brought, obviously, movie scores to the forefront, and not only his own movie scores, but the works of other composers. And really made that a sensation with American orchestras. And then now Keith Lockhart has been in the position for over 20 years, and he's done a lot with rock music and pop music and the Boston Pops. So only three conductors with the Boston Pops, but that's still the orchestra that most people associate as the principal Pops orchestra in the world.
So I'm guessing that families will be encouraged to come en masse to the concert this Saturday because kids are going to Kids are going to freak out over all this Harry Potter music. They'll love it.
They'll love it, absolutely. And we do encourage everybody, if they wish, to come in costume. I like this concert in particular every year because it comes just right after Halloween. And as a parent of two young boys who are running around the house in their superhero costumes all week, getting ready for trick-or-treat, you know, why do we say we have to put those costumes away right after Halloween? You can wear it if it's a Harry Potter costume. Great. I've seen many of my adult friends dressed up as Dumbledore and Harry, all of the characters. So it's really an informal concert, and that's what we do hope we get out the word about, is that this is meant to be enjoyed by children and adults. Anybody who has not stepped foot to a Butler County Symphony concert before, I think this is a great opportunity to expose the little ones to orchestral music and the instruments of the orchestra. We do have, in addition to the Harry Potter scores, we do have three other works that are, one in particular is very well known, The Sorcerer's Apprentice by Paul Dukas, which was made so famous in Disney's 1940 Fantasia. Of course, it's the sequence where Mickey Mouse, the young apprentice of a wizard, takes a stab at trying to waken the brooms up to clean up a mess, and we all know how that goes. It ends terribly, but that score is another example of how sorcery and magic have come into play, you know, well over 200 years into composers' compositions. Their creativity seems to be awakened by magic and wizards and all of that.
So this was a piece, a classical piece that was already written and published and performed, and then Disney put it in his film, or was it composed strictly for that film?
It was a piece of classical music that was inspired by, it's actually an old Goethe poem about the young sorcerer's apprentice. So it's just a work that Disney got his hands on, and I believe we've talked about this maybe a few years ago about the real brilliance of Walt Disney as a visionary and a creative artist, that he could do something that no one had ever thought of in 1940. I mean, of course, he had Snow White and animation, you know, he was at the forefront of innovation for animation, but to conceive of a feature-length film using classical music to inspire animation, I mean, it's almost always that the music comes into play after a film is finished. Either a composer will write music to fit all of the sequences of the film, or they'll use classical music to kind of patch places or to fill out the emotion of the screen. But in this case, Disney just pick some of the greatest classical music ever written, like the Rite of Spring and Beethoven's Sixth Symphony, The Nutcracker. In this case, he picked The Sorcerer's Apprentice, and his creative team came up with some just amazing images. Over 70 years later, this film is still one of the great creative films, really, ever, I would think, in my opinion.
Fantasia actually can also refer to a type of music, can it not? I mean, not a specific title?
That's absolutely right, and interesting that one of the selections in the movie Fantasia is Bach's Toccata and Fugue. A Fantasia is basically an improvisation, something with very loose borders, very loose structure, as opposed to, you know, the symphonic sonata allegro form, to use throw out a big word there. But, you know, think of that as architecture, a building that has all of the beams and structure in place, whereas a Fantasia is just kind of open walls and something where you can really go in any direction that you want. And that's kind of how that movie feels to watch it, that you flow from one sequence to another. These composers like Bach and Beethoven and Stravinsky, it really is just almost like a dreamlike quality to that film, which I think is so impressive. Who else would think of a hippopotamus with a tutu dancing around? I mean, it's genius and very inspired what Walt Disney came up with that film.
So Beethoven, Bach, and others were doing this improvisation, and we thought it all started with jazz, Matthew, a little bit earlier than that, I guess. Huh?
Bach, it's interesting you mentioned, and Bach is one of the most famous examples of improvisation in classical music. He would go on for hours, it's recorded, making improvisations on themes that he would write, imagining these fugues, very complicated works, and all of it was done on the organ, which he was a master of. Just improvisation, basically. I don't know if they called it jamming back then, 300 years ago. Probably not, but still very comparable to what we have in jazz.
Now, did you say there were a couple of other pieces in addition to the Harry Potter scores that are going to be featured in the program this Saturday night?
We do. We have one piece that is very popular, might not be recognizable by its name, but it's the Ritual Fire Dance by a Spanish composer named Manuel de Falla. He wrote a ballet score called El Amor Brujo, which translates as love, comma, the magician. And it's about a young girl who is haunted by the ghost of her deceased husband. And he was not a very nice man, so she's trying to rid herself of this apparition. And she belongs to a tribe of gypsies, and they all circle around her, and they dance faster and faster. The ghost appears, and the dance just keeps getting faster and louder, and it draws the ghost spirit into the fire, and it disappears at that point. This is a ballet score, and then like all of Manuel de Falla's music, it reflects the Spanish sound that he really brought to the classical forefront. His name is really well documented for posterity in classical music because he's the one that revitalized Spanish classical music. He is the most important Spanish composer we have in a country that really did not have much for classical music up until his point. Most of the music coming from Spain was written by Italians or Frenchmen who had relocated there, but he created the Andalusian sound, the sound of flamenco guitar translated to an orchestra. It's a terrific piece. It's really a virtuosic piece for the orchestra. And another example of how magic and sorcery appears in classical music. And the other one is a real treat. Anatol Liadov is a Russian composer who the most famous anecdote about Liadov is that he was the laziest classical musician composer ever, that he lost out on many opportunities just because he could never finish a project. He would a lollygag and just not ever get anything done. And this is documented by composers like Prokofiev and Rimsky-Korsakov. He actually lost out the commission to Diaghilev's Firebird, which Stravinsky ended up getting, and we're performing Stravinsky's Firebird to close our season. But he did write three interesting little pieces, and one of them is called Baba Yaga. It's the story of the Russian witch. Maybe your classical music listeners will recognize Baba Yaga from Mussorgsky's Pictures at an Exhibition. So it's about a witch who lives in a hut that is perched on top of chicken legs. It's a famous Russian legend, but this three-minute piece depicts the witch flying through the air. So we have witches and wizards all represented in addition to Harry Potter on this program.
All very apropos for just a couple of days after Halloween.
Absolutely right. That's with the chill in the air. The children will still have hopefully some of their candy left. They won't have eaten it at all. And again, an opportunity to come in and hear music from John Williams, the first three film scores. We've also got Alexander Desplat, a composer who scored The Deathly Hallows, which will perform. Nicholas Hooper, a composer who scored The Order of the Phoenix. And lastly, Patrick Doyle, the composer for Goblet of Fire. All of this is broken up into very small increments. There'll be a little bit of narration as we segue from one piece to the other, but all of the famous scenes from the Harry Potter films will be there.
Now, is this, and I'm sure I'm using the wrong term for orchestral, but in choral music it would be a medley. Is this already prepared? Are there people who have scored this, or do you have to decide yourself which particular scores you're going to use and then mesh them together?
That's actually a terrific and very interesting question that you asked, Dave, because it's a combination of both. In the case of the music that is not John Williams's, somebody has already put them together in what we call a medley. Mm-hmm. Basically, how a film score works is that it's, you know, if you watch a film, it's actually the music kind of often comes in and out. The only time, generally, that music is ever kind of created with a beginning and an ending are for the opening credits and the closing credits, what they call the end credits.
Yeah.
Everything else in between is meant to flow in and out. So you have to do something with it. In the case of John Williams actually has created his own concert versions so that the music doesn't just disappear or doesn't just stop abruptly. So in his case, he's done it all to make it accessible and playable for orchestras and concerts.
Interesting. We're talking with Matthew Kramer. He's the musical director and conductor of the Butler County Symphony Orchestra, and they're in concert this coming Saturday evening, November 3rd, Butler Intermediate High School Auditorium. You can get tickets or ticket information at the Symphony office, which is on the Diamond downtown, or you can go online to butlersymphony.org. They'll have all the information for you there as well. And a wonderful opportunity to take young people. It could be your kids. Heck, it could be your grandkids or your nieces and nephews. An opportunity to introduce them to a live symphony. Maybe they've never seen it before. And this is certainly something that they would enjoy. With half the program, the magical music of Harry Potter. Tickets, by the way, are $25 for adults, $8 per student. I don't know how the Symphony Board does it with those incredible bargain prices for young people, but, I guess they've made a commitment. They think that's very important, don't they, Matthew?
Absolutely do, and we just have a real jewel right here in Butler County. Of course, there's a world-class orchestra, a short drive away down in Pittsburgh, but we provide top-quality classical music. The orchestra is playing at its highest level ever, and you don't have to worry about parking. Tickets are so affordable. This is a great way to be introduced to the instruments of the orchestra, hear some familiar tunes. I mean, really, this is the kind of concert that brings everybody in, I think.
I want to talk a little bit about the Symphony's educational outreach program. I know you've been involved with this personally, and I understand you're going to be doing it again this year.
That's right, year number 5. This has really been one of the most important educational initiatives for the Butler County Symphony. We get out into the area schools with a program every year that's always designed around school curriculum. So we play music by great composers. We introduce the instruments of the orchestra, but we show how all of this ties into things that they're learning in school. We had our very first year a program associated with English language skills that showed word families and instrument families and how things that sound the same belong in the same family. Last year we had a program that we designed specifically about the orchestra working together as a team, and we've done just about everything, Peter and the Wolf, of course. This year's program is called How the Orchestra Grew, and we take a look at the evolution and the addition of musical instruments over the course of about 300 years of music. So we have some Handel, Mozart, Beethoven, Wagner. We have, in addition to that, Leonard Bernstein's Candide Overture, since we're still celebrating his 100th birthday, and some jazz music as well. And the central piece of that program is a work called The Thrill of the Orchestra that does introduce every instrument, the sound of the instrument, and what it looks like and how it sounds to be played. So it's a chance for us to get into 5 different schools across the county and show off our wonderful musicians and introduce kids probably for the very first time to the sounds of an orchestra.
And that's going to take place later this week, folks, in advance of the November 3rd concert, which is this coming Saturday. But the educational outreach program will be presented as a 30-minute assembly in the Butler, Slippery Rock, and Mars area school districts, and also at Penn Christian Academy. And this is not just a talk. I mean, that would be fine. You'll have, about 25 musicians from the orchestra actually there to perform for the students live?
That's right. And almost all of the instruments of the orchestra are represented. No harp on this particular program. That's quite a difficult instrument to transport from one place to the other. But we have all of our strings are there, the woodwinds, the brass, and percussion as well. So what's so nice about this is that the students are actually very close to the orchestra. So they get up close, and in some cases they can even feel the vibrations of the instrument. So very important for us to continue to enrich and entertain our audiences through our 6 normal concerts, but we do a great deal that maybe many people aren't aware of out in the community to help promote classical music, to support our music programs in our schools, and to help introduce children to the sounds of an orchestra.
And you'll be there. You'll actually be conducting, right?
Oh, absolutely. And I'm also the narrator, the person who kind of takes the children through the program. So like I said, we start with Handel and what life was like for a person in the early 1700s. And as the society in which this music was written continues to evolve. So did the instruments in the orchestra. And it's a fascinating thing, I think, also for the teachers, that maybe they don't know some of the things about the particular composers. Everybody seems to get something out of these programs, not just the students.
You never know when you pick up a little bit of trivia. One of my favorite trivia questions about Handel is, where was the Messiah first performed? And people would never guess that it was in Dublin, Ireland, but that is absolutely the correct answer. At Christ
That's Church. Absolutely right. It's one of those pieces. It's probably the piece that is performed most, I think, in the entire classical collection, because whether it's at Christmas time or during Easter, that piece continues to resonate so many years later. And you're absolutely right. He used it many times in many different forms, which is why there are different versions of it. As fundraisers for the sick and for the children who were starving, he did a lot of great work with that while he was still alive, Handel.
Yep. Premiered at Christ Church Cathedral in Dublin. That church is still there, too, by the way. Does the symphony help to fund this this educational outreach program? There's got to be some expense here. My goodness, you're taking 25 musicians to all these different schools over a three-day period.
That's right. It is an expense that we have committed ourselves to. These programs are presented at no cost to the school.
Wow.
You can imagine what that would cost if the children were to get on the yellow school buses, and transportation budgets being so prohibitive and very difficult to navigate with the schedules. We go directly to the schools and set up on or the cafeteria, the auditorium, whatever each school has. We make ourselves at home there, and we have just some wonderful people behind the scenes who are working to make all of this logistically happening. In particular, our board president, Patty Stagno, has just been wonderful in working with our school administrators to make this happen. And, of course, to the people who pledged their support financially. That's what makes this happen. We couldn't do it without the financial resources of these wonderful people.
Well, this is something I'd love to have experienced when I was a kid. Have live symphony musicians there talking about the various instruments. Although I must say, when I was in elementary school, we had a wonderful music appreciation teacher who did this, believe it or not, with old records, Matthew. He had a portable record player that he would bring into the classroom and then recordings, records of... he'd play something, what instrument is this? And, you had to guess whether it was a bassoon or a saxophone or whatever. I remember it well. To be able to do that for the kids with live instruments, that's amazing. Good stuff.
That's right.
The Magical Music of Harry Potter, the concert is this Saturday night at Butler Intermediate High School Auditorium. Will you be giving a pre-concert talk for this one, Matthew?
I will indeed at 6:30 to talk about, of course, the classical selections like The Sorcerer's Apprentice, but also to talk about the movie scoring industry, which I have talked about at previous pre-concert lectures. But it really is fascinating, the composers like John Williams from the old school, in addition to these younger composers who are making their mark now in cinematic programming. So 6:30, join me, and we'll have some anecdotes to share about the program.
I think that's just fabulous. It's like going to a stage play and being able to read some notes before the show starts, so you get a little bit of background and you're able to understand it better. I think that's great stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And, boy, if you ever need an example, there have been a lot of spooky Halloween-type movies on Turner Classic Movies over the past few days. And if you ever needed an example of how music can affect the film experience, the movie experience, just listen to some of the music that Hitchcock and some of the other masters used in their films. If that doesn't make the hair on the back of your neck stand up, I don't know what will. Yeah. Wow, good stuff.
That's absolutely right.
And you mentioned that kids will recognize from the first few notes some of this music from the Harry Potter films. They'll know which film it was. Just like some of us who are a little bit older can hear the first two or three notes of the Jaws soundtrack, Matthew, and instantly know what they're talking about, instantly transformed back to a hot summer day in the 70s.
You just hit on a movie that's just wrecked me for the rest of my life. I can't even get into a pond without thinking about that theme as it comes. And two notes, two oscillating notes, a half step apart. Who would have thought that would instill such fear in people? But John Williams knew how to do it.
You have to wonder, I don't know whether he ever grants interviews or what, but how a master like John Williams goes about it. And, you know, it's not just a one-shot wonder, you know, like To Kill a Mockingbird, Harper Lee. The guy just has done it over and over and over again with so many iconic movie themes. You wonder what his methodology is, you know. Does he wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning with an idea, or, you know, does he sit down with a pot of coffee?
It is remarkable, Dave, honestly. I can't name too many other instances of this, that somebody... in his mid-80s, is still able to generate melodies like that. Composers often dry out. I mean, it's fascinating. Sibelius stopped composing in the last 50 years of his life. Composers like Rachmaninoff just even said that they were just running out of the melodic ideas that they had when they were younger. Mm-hmm. Here, John Williams still has it. It's remarkable.
Yeah, some composers. I was just reading about Mozart. It was last week because... who was the rival? Antonio Salieri, was that...
Yeah, Salieri, yes.
Salieri, I'm sorry. As I was reading up on him, because it would have been his birthday last week, I read once again that Mozart died when he was 35.
That's right. Wow. Schubert died when he was in his late 20s. Mendelssohn died before his 40th birthday. It's just tragic what, you know, the lives, the talent that was lost. Just because, obviously, 200 years ago, 100 years ago, medicine wasn't nearly what it is now. Life expectancy was far shorter, and the great works of art that were lost forever because an artist died before their time.
Just imagine if Mozart or Beethoven or some of them could have lived as long as John Williams and still been working. Wow. Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, listen, Matthew, I've got to let you go. Always good to talk with you. Always good to learn a little bit, not only about music, but especially about what the symphony is doing. It's the 70th anniversary of the Butler Symphony this year. And the concert season is underway. Second concert is this coming Saturday. Again, check with the symphony office on the Diamond for ticket information, or you can do that online, too, at butlersymphony.org. Matthew Kramer, good to talk with you, my friend. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Dave. Appreciate it.
All right. So long now. Matthew Kramer, musical director and conductor of the Butler Symphony. What a gem we have in the Butler Symphony, huh? Really, very high-class orchestra. Not too many communities our size. When I speak of the community, I mean the whole Butler County community can boast of a symphony of that quality, that's for sure. Okay, take a break. We're going to be talking about Guatemala coming up on the next segment of the program, so please stick around. You're listening to It's Your Turn here on WISR. It's the Monday edition, October 29th, and we'll be back to meet our next guests in just a couple of minutes. Be right back. The Young Funeral Home of Butler invites you to stop by their Jefferson Street location, downtown Butler, to talk about pre-arrangements. Not the easiest thing to do, but necessary. And the Young family will walk you through the process, making it very comfortable and really easy to take care of. You'll experience peace of mind knowing that your wishes and plans will be carried out to the last detail. Call the Young Funeral Home in Butler today to make an appointment with a member of the Young family. Generations of the Young family have been caring for generations of Butler families for well over 40 years. The Young Funeral Home, West Jefferson Street in Butler. Hey folks, have you heard about Going Postal Butler, your friendly neighborhood shipping center? Yeah, they're located just off Newcastle Road, Shockey Lane, right behind King's and Villa Grande. Going Postal Butler. They package your items for shipping. And that takes care of a situation that sometimes can be a real bother. You know, you got to get the wrapping paper, the string, the tape, whatever you need. They'll do it for you. And you can ship any way you want to, FedEx, UPS, U.S. Postal Service. They will package your items for shipping at Going Postal Butler. Other services they offer, copying, scanning, faxing, mailbox rentals, custom boxes. They have an official notary, also greeting cards, even a lottery agent. Going Postal Butler, 140 Shockey Lane, That's just off Newcastle Road, right behind King's and Villa Grande restaurants. It's in the Shockey Mini Storage area. For more information, give them a call, 724-841-0044. Go on Postal Butler, your friendly neighborhood shipping center. Welcome back, good friends. Great to have you with us on a pretty miserable day weather-wise again. Boy, the rain we've had, the summer, the fall. We had a nice couple of weeks stretch there back in late September, early October, and then we fell right back into this swampy stuff. It's just not very pretty out there at all. Well, we'll make our own sunshine here as we move on with the Monday edition of It's Your Turn. Several guests are here to talk about Guatemalan missions. We're talking about Guatemala, Central America. Let's introduce our guests. First of all, Gretchen Carreri is here. Gretchen is an acquaintance of long standing. Gretchen, good to see you. Nice to have you back with us.
It's nice to be here, Dave.
Also with us is Father Dan Warszewski. How'd I do in a pronunciation there?
Pretty good. Warszewski.
Warszewski.
Well, that's your slide.
I'll work on it. I'll work on it, Father Dan. Father Dan is one of the new priests for Butler area Catholic parishes, right?
That's correct. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, well, welcome to Butler.
Thanks.
You've been here for like, I don't know what, 10 days or something like that?
Yep, almost 2 weeks now.
Hardly enough to know your way around yet, huh?
Little by little.
Well, nice to have you here. And also visiting with us is Phil Miller. Phil, nice to have you as well.
Pleasure.
Yeah. So, Gretchen, just for to set the stage for us here a little bit, because at Holy Sepulchre Parish, which is your parish, you've been involved with the mission work in Guatemala for some time, haven't you?
We have. And we brought Phil because he's the one who really introduced this mission to us at Holy Sepulchre. And as part of our support for that mission, we try to raise money for various projects down there. And part of our fundraising efforts will be a fair trade sale on Saturday, November 10th. So if you're familiar with fair trade, as I'm pretty sure you are, we have five vendors this year. They all bring articles from craftsmen around the world. Part of fair trade philosophy is that a company will go in and help these local craftsmen know what to make, maybe give them some money, startup money, to get a little local business going, mm-hmm. and bring the products here and sell them in our country.
Where is the fair trade event going to be on November 10th?
At Holy Sepulchre School, mm-hmm. which is Old Route 8, Butler, about 12 miles south of the city of Butler.
I got the right date, right? Saturday, November 10th?
That's correct.
Okay. And do you know the hours?
From 9 in the morning till 6 in the afternoon.
Okay. Well, we'll go over that again before we wrap up. But just wanted to set the stage. Phil Miller, how did you get involved with this? Gretchen said you're the one who kind of brought it to the attention of the folks at Holy Sepulchre.
Well, I was hitchhiking one day in 1971. I went from Columbus, Ohio, where I lived, down to Colombia, where I worked on a coffee plantation.
Wait a minute. You hitchhiked to Colombia, South America?
Right. Anyhow, it was a great year. The Pirates won the World Series. It was when Clemente took over the series. It was wonderful.
I hitchhiked to Shakora once. I thought that was rough.
Anyhow, the most beautiful place that I encountered in the whole trip was Guatemala. Mm-hmm. And take a break, 15, 20 years later, I was a parishioner at St. Anne of Waynesburg, and our pastor, Al McGinnis, took a trip to Patzún, Guatemala, mm-hmm. to visit a mission and be with a former parishioner, and came back with stories about the mission. And we the people there in Waynesburg, demanded that he take us. And I've been going for 25 years now.
Oh, my. Wow.
The missions are Franciscan missions. They're indigenous to Mexico and Central America. They have an orphanage, which had a high of 90 kids there. It's about 45 right now. Mm-hmm. A hospital and with a catchment of 70,000 people. That just means there are 70,000 people who live in the region that might go there. And a school, which now is about 1,000 students. And what Holy Sep is supporting in particular is the school. There are other parishes and schools that are focused on supporting the orphanage and the hospital.
Father Dan, what's your connection with all of this? Did you hitchhike to Colombia as well? Or?
No, that's a little too wild and crazy for me. Phil is my connection. Back at Aquinas in ninth grade, I can remember being in the back of chemistry class, and his son, James, asked me, how would you like to go to Guatemala this summer? Huh? So for a kid from Westview, never been out of the country before, I jumped at the chance, promptly fell in love with it, with all the wonderful people down there, with the way that they love each other, that they have such a great community, and especially the religious sisters. I saw them not only wearing, you know, their habit and their veil, but all the joy that they had and the warmth as they welcomed us and invited us to be part of their mission, serving the poor there, especially the indigenous there in a small town of Patzún in Guatemala. And I've been coming ever since. It was about 16 years ago, 2002.
Wow. You said Aquinas. Is that Aquinas Academy? Is that where you went to high school?
Yeah, right in Gibsonia. Yep.
Mm-hmm. That must have been quite a trip for a high school kid.
Oh, yeah. It was amazing. And we had a couple other people from Aquinas join us for that year. And still some memories we talk about to this day. Wonderful trip.
These are Franciscan missions, did you say, Phil, down there?
That's right.
Mm-hmm. So Franciscans, the order founded by St. Francis, right?
That's correct.
Yeah, St. Francis of Assisi.
There turns out there are lots of different Franciscan mission groups. This is a group of women that were founded in Mexico shortly before Mexico outlawed the Catholic Church, so they had to go underground for a while. But the women have remained quite faithful and do a fantastic job, but need support, and that's where we come in.
Let's talk a little bit about the missions there in Patzún. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
That's exactly correct.
Patzún. And is this a smaller community? How would we compare it with the town around here?
It would be pretty different than the towns around here.
Oh, okay.
They're called municipios. And in the rural area, the way things are organized, the municipio will have a number of outlying villages which identify with it.
Mm-hmm.
So among the things that you can expect from a municipio is a particular way of dressing, and what I'm holding up now is a typical colors of the blouse that a female would wear in Patzún. So all over Guatemala you'll see people wearing their home team colors.
That's very deep red, almost bordering on red-purple.
Yep.
Pretty.
It is pretty. About 50,000 people live in Patzún now. There are 22 aldeas or outlying villages, which vary from maybe as few as 100 people to some that are over 1,000 people. The transportation is still quite poor outside of the city to the aldeas, and so the people who identify with Patzún may get there no more often than once a year or even less.
Mm. I am searching back through my memory banks, trying to remember the capital of Guatemala. Is it Guatemala City? Am I right on that?
It is now. Originally, it was a place called Antigua. The Spaniards put it there. Beautiful location, but they left because of a terrible earthquake. And you may remember from June, there was a terrible volcanic eruption of a volcano named Fuego, which means fire, which is just a few miles from Antigua. So it's still a geologically quite active, young, and dangerous area.
How far from the capital of the country is Patzún?
Well, it used to be a three-hour drive, and now it's a one-hour drive without traffic, but there's never without traffic. So it's still a three-hour drive.
What, did they build an interstate or something?
It was the Pan-American Highway all along, but at the time that I started, the Pan-American Highway was visually indistinguishable from a country road, which was only partially paved.
Hmm.
Now it looks a lot more like a modern highway.
I haven't heard that term since I was in sixth grade, I think. Pan-American Highway, son of a gun.
Yeah, it's the old Pan-American Highway. Anyhow, so about an hour outside of Guatemala City, mm-hmm. when you can make it without traffic. But as I say, the traffic has gotten just awful.
So make the connection for us and for our listeners with helping these missions and the fair trade event that's going to happen on November 10th down at Holy Sepulchre School.
Sure. So here's the thing. The people whom we serve are, in fact, the descendants of, they are, in fact, Mayans. They're a particular group of Mayans, the Kechikel Indians. And not only is the country of Guatemala quite poor, but people who are full-blood indigenous are even poorer than that. And so the people in particular whom we help are kids who have no parents or whose parents have gotten into such straits that they have to be taken out of the homes. So we're literally helping the poorest of the poor, some of the survivors of the earthquake, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. The connection is, well, how do you stop being poor? The kinds of things that people like us are good at doing are what's called development. So we're not the first responders. We don't go in when there's an earthquake or a volcanic eruption. What we do is long-term stuff, building up a hospital that is high quality, building up a school which has good quality of education. And the thing that I'd like people to remember is that people are poor only insofar as they are not able to make meaningful decisions over their own lives. Mm. What we're trying to do is give them the tools to do that.
So the people in this area of Guatemala, they make things?
They sure do, yeah. There's still a lot of what you would call traditional crafts. Weaving is very big. If you have any weavers in the audience, they probably know of the Guatemala weaving. Maybe they visit Neibar, one of the centers that is famous for that. The economy there has traditionally been you work on land that you don't own, raising either broccoli or China peas. It's a tough living. Or you leave town. Hmm. And so that's what guys do. What women typically do is they make stuff, you know, like the weaving and embroidery that you see here. There's also a lot of tacos, tres tiempos por día. So people will make the tacos and the tortillas and sell those on the street for a living. It is still the case that market day is a huge day and people come from miles around to sell their wares, their vegetables, etc.
Well, what items will be available at Holy Sepulchre School? I assume mostly these knitted crafts, is that right?
That will be some of it. There's a lot more of it. We decided, Holy Sep decided to draw on a number of different vendors from all over the world that are still making traditional crafts. Gretchen, do you want to fill us in on that?
Sure. You would find at this fair trade sale baskets, housewares, coffee, tea, chocolate, soup mixes, some Christmas items. Typically there's some nativity sets and other, you know, Christmas ornaments,
mm-hmm.
Table runners, tablecloths, placemats, jewelry, lots of jewelry from all different countries. And then there's always surprises. So our biggest vendor is 10,000 Villages, which some people may know that they have a store in Pittsburgh. They have stores across the country, actually. And they've been our main vendor. But we have this year four other smaller vendors. So each of these vendors have a particular part of the world that they bring items from. So we're looking to see a lot of new things this year. So even if you have come to this sale before, come again because you will see things you haven't ever seen before.
I have nativity sets. You know, I was looking for one a couple of years ago, and I couldn't find one that really tripped my trigger. You know, I mean, there's some really modern ones these days. They just look like rocks to me. Yeah. It didn't look like,
We usually have nativity sets from the Holy Land, from Bethlehem, that are carved in the olive wood.
Mm-hmm.
So come on November 10th, you'll find.
Now, if you buy something there or buy a number of things, part of that will eventually make its way back to these people in Guatemala?
That's right. That's how these vendors work, is they give us a certain percentage of what they sell. It's usually between 10 and 15%.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have a huge bake sale also. And people from the parish donate to that, and we get 100% of the profit from that, so that's always nice.
Is this a particular mission work of Holy Sepulchre Parish?
Well, no, as Phil said, other churches around here do support Potsoon. St. Richard's in Gibsonia is probably the closest other parish.
Mm-hmm.
And St. Anne's in Waynesburg, where Phil started, they still support them. And there are some other groups. But we have focused mostly on the school. We do particular things for the school. For example, Phil has worked with building up their computer program there because that's kind of his expertise. The year that my husband and I traveled to Potsoon, we were installing water, pure water tanks, not tanks.
Yeah, water purification devices.
Water purification devices. Because in the classrooms of this school, there was no water available.
Oh, my.
And these children go to school from 7 in the morning until about 1 o'clock. But they have no lunch. There's no food service like children here mm-hmm. are expecting. Mm-hmm. And they were in classrooms with nothing to drink. So just putting in these pure water devices in each classroom was something we thought was important to them.
We talked with Father Dan a little bit about his memories of Guatemala. Have you been back, by the way, since that summer in high school?
I have been, yeah, a number of times, probably about 10.
Oh, wow.
But it's taken about a 4 or 5 year break because I got Montezuma's Revenge 1 year early mm-hmm. in seminary. So just went back my deacon year, and then one time
Gretchen
as a priest.
Was talking about it. Drink bottled water.
I know. You got to be careful down there. Yeah, a lot of beautiful memories. One of the first times I was there, Pope John Paul II announced after we had already made our plans, Phil and I, to go with that Aquinas group, that he was going to come down and canonize the first Guatemalan saint. So his name was Hermano Pedro. He was a Franciscan who served in Antigua back in the 1500s, the poor back then. He was the first saint to be canonized for Guatemala. So that was an amazing experience to see John Paul II and to see all the people there. Usually when we go, we do a lot of manual labor, but we try to split the time between doing work, because as Americans, we love to get her done, right? But also having relationships with the people. So especially with the orphans, they're huge bundles of joy. They love to be, taken around like little helicoptered around and, playing on the swings and the monkey bars and soccer and all that, and even playing with the kids at the school after hours and talking with the older children, helping them learn their English. A lot of good memories like that. And usually the sisters, to show us as a token of their appreciation, they always love taking us to real far away places on a journey. So one time they took us all the way to the other side of Guatemala to a Benedictine monastery to show us the black Jesus, the Jesus Negro. We made a pilgrimage out there. So seen a lot of neat and very beautiful, picturesque things, had a lot of wonderful times and met some truly amazing people down there.
Has Christianity become the dominant religion there? I think Phil said there's remnants of Mayan culture there, and of course, I can't believe I'm trying to remember back to my sixth grade geography class here, but there were Native Americans, Aztec, Toltec, Mayan cultures, some of them extremely advanced, by the way. These are the people that built Teotihuacan and Chichen Itza and some of these other incredible architectural works in Mexico and the Yucatan and so on.
Yeah, that's right. It was the Mayans who had the particular knack for stargazing. And if you study the ancient Mayan calendar, as I have, you'll find that what it's really focused on, it's not focused on the year that we know. They didn't care so much about the seasons. They cared a lot about celestial events. And it would be a long conversation to tell you exactly how it works. But let me tell you, 28 is a really important number because that's the lunar cycle.
So has Christianity kind of incorporated some of the ancient cultures? This has happened in many other countries, by the way.
Sure. By far the dominant religion throughout Latin America is Catholicism. There are a couple things about Guatemala that are a bit surprising. One is it is the least Catholic and the most indigenous of all the Central American countries, mm-hmm. But it's still predominantly Catholic. The reason it is the least Catholic is a long time ago, like 1850, the Guatemalans, who were mixed between European or pure European and the locals, decided they wanted to use, quote, the American model, and basically collectivize the land under wealthy owners, have people work on it, and raise the economy and the lives of everyone. And step one was to take the land away from the indigenous, which they did. And so that's sort of how the poverty got insisted. But the Catholicism was there. And it turns out that the reason it's the least Catholic is the Catholics were saying, you know, you really can't take the land of these people. And what happened is the government invited in other Christian groups, which bought into the notion that everybody would be better off if modern farming methods were used and so on and so forth. So that sort of drove down Catholicism and indeed is the reason why people were invited to come take empty parishes in the 1960s.
You have some items that you've brought in with you. Can we describe those? Obviously, people on the radio can't see them, but that beautiful woven cloth that you held up there.
Yeah, I'll hold it up so the audience can see it better.
Is that, would that have been fashioned into a garment of some sort?
Yeah, the blouse that the women wear in the traditional villages is modeled on this. It's an open-armed blouse with a neck that's sort of a boat neck.
It's very colorful, and I'll show my extreme lack of knowledge of sewing skills, but it looks like that's embroidery on there, those colored leaves.
Yeah, what every Guatemalan woman will do is get cloth like this and then make it her own by the embroidery that goes on it. A lot of it looks very similar.
Mm-hmm. It's beautiful.
But they are distinct. Another thing that happens a lot in Guatemala is what's called primitive arts. And so people paint. They paint with paints they've mixed themselves for centuries, mm-hmm. Depicting things that are, well, part of their lives. And so what you see here is coffee. Patsun is slightly too high for coffee itself, but some of its aldeas are places where coffee is.
High, you mean in terms of altitude above
altitude.
Sea level?
Oh, yeah, it's about 2,000 meters high, so that's pretty far up there. You go up over the lip of the mountain and start sliding down toward Lake Atitlan, and you get some marvelously fertile coffee land. Mm-hmm. And so the coffees of Antigua are quite well known now in the United States and really tasty because it's really tough to beat volcanic soil and perfect growing weather.
That's an interesting point of view. It's a bird's eye point of view on several, it looks like, coffee bean pickers, I guess.
That's right.
Looking up almost like a Salvador Dali there. That's just a point of view.
One of my favorite times to be in Patsun or Guatemala in the rural areas in general is the cosecha, the harvest. Because while people are generally quite poor, they're not poor at the end of harvest. You harvest up the broccoli, you harvest up the China peas, or you pick the coffee, and then people have money for a while. That's the same feeling that I used to get when I lived in Greene County. When we were doing hay, you'd spend some really tough days, but at the end you'd have enough put away and you'd have some money in your pocket. It was pretty great.
What are China peas?
Snow peas, snap peas. They were not native to the area, but a priest, a Franciscan Padre Justiniano from Italy, came there and thought that the land would be suitable for that and that it could be an export crop. And while he could not make things fair for everybody, could at least see to it that there would be some crops that would have a good market and people would have some money. And so he introduced China peas. Mm-hmm. And the rest is their local history.
You went down there, Father Dan, in the summer, I guess, right? Whenever you're, obviously because you were still in high school, your first trip.
That's correct, yep.
So is it hotter than blue blazes in Guatemala in the middle of the summer?
Well, that's the irony. Like Phil said, since we're up pretty high altitude-wise, it's actually colder. There's been a number of times when I've gone, and it's been cooler there than when I left Pittsburgh and cooler than when I came back. Hmm. So you want to bundle up at night. It can drop pretty low. What's nice, though, is since you're up pretty high in the altitude, you don't have a whole lot of bugs, so that's helpful. But the air's a little thinner, so you're playing those Guatemala kids on the basketball court or the soccer field. You better make sure to catch your breath and not run as hard as you're used to, or you'll be feeling it in a couple minutes.
Some of the migrants that are trying to get to the United States and claim asylum are concerned about violence in Guatemala and in neighboring Honduras. Did you experience any of that when you were down there, either one of you?
I have not.
So here's how it works. Places where there's drugs or drugs are passing through on their way to the U.S., There's lots of violence because there's lots of money and drugs, and oh, by the way, they become drug users. Potsoon is out of the way of that. So it has not experienced the drug violence. It has not experienced AIDS. It has plenty of its own problems, but those are not problems that we know there. Other of the Franciscan missions, lower down in the capital city, yeah, big problems. In El Salvador, in Honduras, yeah, big, big problems of the kind that you just mentioned.
Hmm.
If I may, I just want to say a couple of things about people migrating illegally into the country.
Please do.
So here's a scoop. You think, well, you know, they're coming here for a better life. Indeed, I'm sure they are, many, maybe most. But it turned out there's an anthropologist who does a lot of work in Guatemala. He studied this a long time and came up with some conclusions that surprised him. Not only is it kind of bad for the American communities, it turns out to be especially bad for the Guatemalan communities from which these people migrate. Here's why. If you try to make a break for the U.S., it's going to cost you $5,000, $7,000 to make an attempt to get across. It usually takes an average of two attempts to get across. Where are people going to have $14,000? The answer is they have really only one thing that is of that kind of value, and it's the home in which they live, which may have been in the family for generations. That is put up to a bank or to a private lender to get the money to make it across. If you don't make it across, where are you now? Well, if you're lucky, you get back to Guatemala. But whatever is the case, you no longer own a house.
You're
now,
homeless,
how do you?
Yeah.
Right. So not only do you lose your own property, but because some people do make it across and money comes in, it turns out that the prices for housing are driven up. So people who were desperately poor are now becoming even more poor. One of the other shocking conclusions of this work, by the way, the name of the book is El Norte or Bust. Terrible name, great book. And the author is David Stoll, S-T-O-L-L. One of the other surprising conclusions was, he said, I expected to find that the Guatemalans were systematically exploited by the whites in America. He said, I was half right. They were systematically, or they are systematically exploited. But it turns out the people who are exploiting them were the previous generation, or previous wave of migrants. So it turns out that what people think is going to be their way out turns out to be generally bad news. There's a lot of legal, L-E-G-A-L, as in it's okay, it's according to the law, annual work in Canada. And so some of the people that I know and have worked with in Potsoon are there in the summers working hard and bringing serious money back home to their families. The only cases that I know of personally from Potsoon are horrific, just terrible cases that have not worked out well at all.
What about, Father Dan, what about living conditions? What did you experience on your many trips down there? Are the houses
sure.
Okay? Are they incredibly primitive, or what are we looking at?
Yeah, I'd say pretty primitive. You'll have kind of your metal roofs. They had a huge earthquake back in 1976. Like Phil said, it's on some tectonic plates there. So they went away from that tile-style roof that you think of when you think of Central America because they were afraid those came down and they injured and killed a lot of people. So very primitive, a lot of concrete block homes.
Yeah.
I'm a little sensitive to dust and mold, and I think there's a lot of that going on down there inside the homes.
I was trying to visualize and maybe help our listeners visualize, but I can see concrete block with a tin roof.
Think about that, yeah. And of course, painted in bright colors because it is Central America, but yeah, you'll have a lower color, maybe a dark red, and then like a lighter color up top. A lot of the stores along the street are like that as well, and just those metal roofs, yeah. Corrugated steel or whatever it is on top. So it's very primitive, very very different than here. I did a lot of camping as a Boy Scout, so to me it wasn't too bad to rough it. But yeah, for some people, if they came down, they would probably feel it's way out of their comfort zone.
Are there roads and vehicles?
There are, and that's been the neat thing about going down for the last 16 years. When I first went, there was still a number of they have an almost octagonal type brick they use, and a lot of dirt roads. And over the last 16 years, seen such a tremendous increase in their technology. So a lot more paved roads,
they pave them with these bricks.
Sometimes for the poorer places in town, there are more roads with bricks, but a lot of times with concrete or with asphalt. Like you said, the Pan American Highway does seem like a highway, maybe not a 79, but like a Route 8, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's mm-hmm. very travelable. So we've seen that grow over the past number of years, as well as access to electricity, even the internet. It used to take probably 3 months for a round-trip letter to come to the United States and back. Now we have a lot more regular email contact with the sisters down there. That way we can help out in case there's a big need that comes up here or that, or even the possibility of wiring money down there, which I don't think was the case 20 years ago. It's a lot different.
How do you get to Guatemala, by the way, Phil? Can you fly to the capital city and then like take a bus or something? Or what?
Yeah, it turns out it's a lot faster than hitchhiking. So the standard is a flight from Pittsburgh to one of four or five different places in the U.S. that service Guatemala City directly thereafter. This last year, we used Spirit Airline. It was a short, quick flight, and for me, it was fine. For Father Dan, it was disastrous. But yeah, you fly there and fly back.
Mm-hmm. So are there very high mountains around Patzún?
Oh, yeah,
very much so. Yeah. On a clear day, you can see a volcano out in the distance and sometimes even see a little smoke coming up from it. So, yeah, we're on a pretty high enough mountain but surrounded by other higher mountains in the distance.
Mm-hmm. Right. The most beautiful place on Earth, in case you didn't know, is called Lake Atitlan. It's about 20 miles from Patzún. It has three mountains on it, three volcanoes. And the lake itself sits a mile high. The tallest volcano is a mile and a half higher than that, so it sits 2.5 miles. And those volcanic peaks are not even the biggest peaks in the country. So while you think of it's a skinny little country between the Caribbean and the Pacific, but it has some mighty big mountains in between.
Is there cell phone service down there? Can you call back to the U.S.?
There is, but you need to have an international phone. What a lot of us on the mission trips have done recently is there's Wi-Fi now at the place, at the mission. There's two actual missions. There's one at the orphanage and clinic, and that's closer to the center of town where the main parish is, right in the town square. And then up the hill towards the top of town is the K-12 school, or that would be the equivalent here. Their last grades are more like a trade school. Mm-hmm. But both of them now have Wi-Fi. You can, you know, Skype your friends, or you can call home. Apple Talk or whatever you do, yeah.
Where do you stay when you get down there, Father Dan?
Usually you stay at the orphanage. Sometimes we do stay at the K-12 school as well. They usually have guest homes for people that come in to do work. The orphanage especially has had a lot of people come in. I think it's an easier sell with the cute kids. Mm-hmm. And they come down and help out, doing manual labor, doing building, donating money, doing whatever they can to help out.
How many students roughly at the school, a ballpark figure?
1,000 students at the school, divided between preschool, primary school, a middle school, and what's called diversificado, which is kind of like a mix between trade school and college prep. In fact, our school, San Bernardino, was the very first school in that municipio to offer a full secondary education. And so, you know, get this image. Once you got to be about 14, you could either stop school or go live someplace else, or travel, commute daily, which was a dangerous commute, mm-hmm. To someplace else to finish your high school education.
But now they can stay at the...
Now they can stay, and they can get a quality secondary education, and some other institutions in the municipio are now doing that as well. The school itself is high quality. There's testing for the whole state. Generally, our school, San Bernardino, comes out number one in both math and science for the whole state, does less well in the language arts, and I think the reason is that a first language in most homes is not Spanish, it's Quechical, so people are having to work pretty hard to get their Spanish up to snuff.
Mm-hmm.
But it's quality school. You'd ask earlier what happens with the money. I just want to tell you a little bit about that.
Please do.
Some is physical plant repairs. By the time I got Holy Sep involved, I don't think there was a single roof in the place that did not leak. That has been renovated completely. Another is scholarships for kids. The school doesn't teach itself, and there are only 7 or 8 nuns who are on the staff living in community there at the school. And so most of the teaching is done by locals, and there's a mandated minimum wage that school teachers make, and we pay a lot for the for the teachers. We pay to have them get continuing education so that what they're teaching is modern and of great, great use to the people.
Mm-hmm.
I do want to say one thing about the upgrade of the school teaching and learning is that one of the groups that became involved is Oakland Catholic High School. And one of the girls who graduated from that had been a volunteer helping people who were slow learners in the U.S. And she saw the same symptoms among the people in Patzun. So she and her father got busy, formed a 501c3, and took in money to start tutoring program for the people who were slower learners. Now about 20% of the people in the school are involved in this tutoring program. And one thing about the Franciscans is they measure everything. So we have physical, hard evidence, repeatable, that can tell you that this tutoring is having a dramatic positive impact. And in fact, I had the pleasure of sitting and interviewing a bunch of these kids the last time I was there on mission, finding out how they felt about themselves and their standing in school. Great program, great young woman who started it, Claire Jacob, and the kind of impact that a group like ours, that's really pretty modest, can have on a town, on a bunch of people.
I'm learning a lot. Can you folks stick around for a little bit longer?
Sure.
Is that okay? Okay, I need to take a break here. So we'll learn a little bit more about Guatemala and this wonderful program, really, where you can help these people in Patzun, the Patzun Mission. And maybe pick up a couple of nice items, too, for yourself or for gift-giving at the Fair Trade event. We'll give you the details on that again when we come back. You're listening to It's Your Turn on WISR. Stick around. Back in just a moment.
It's never been more important to stay in touch with the events and issues that shape our world. And for more than 25 years, Radio Pennsylvania has been the Commonwealth's source for stories and newsmakers impacting your life.
We're taking precautions to prepare for the worst that this storm can deliver.
And I believe that we need an armed, highly trained security officer in every school.
We should not be using mental illness as a scapegoat for things like mass shootings and violence.
Covering your state capital and all corners of the Commonwealth, Radio PA's team of award-winning journalists is on constant watch as your eyes and ears on the front lines of the major events of our time. Honored for broadcasting and journalistic excellence by
the Associated Press, the Pennsylvania Association of Broadcasters, the National Association of State Radio Networks, the National Headliner Awards, and many others.
8-time winner of the Joe Snyder Award for Outstanding News Service, the top news honor bestowed by the Associated Press in Pennsylvania. The Radio Pennsylvania Network, bringing you closer to Harrisburg and all of your Keystone State.
Welcome back, friends. We're talking about Guatemala generally. We're talking specifically about a fair trade event that's going to happen not this coming Saturday, Gretchen, but it's the following one, right? November 10th?
That's correct.
At Holy Sepulchre School, which, by the way, is right along Route 8 there, isn't it?
Yes.
Actually,
it is.
You have to get off Route 8, though, to get to the school, right?
Well, you'll see what we call our old church right along Route 8, and you turn in there, and the school sits up on the hill, yes. Okay. But there's an electronic message board right there which will direct you.
Yeah. And that's 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. This fair trade event will take place on Saturday, November 10th, and there'll be a wide variety of items there from six or seven vendors who will have these goods.
That's correct. And I guess I see shopping at a fair trade sale as having three prongs to it. One is you help the people who make the items, the local artisans. You're mm-hmm. you're helping support and give them a living, you know. Second of all, you're getting a really unique gift for somebody, whether it's for yourself or your family or your Christmas list or whatever. I mean, these aren't things you're going to find in your local stores. You know, they're unusual. So it's your chance to get some unusual Christmas things. And that's the third thing, is you can whittle down that Christmas list of yours. You know, mm-hmm. So plus, we have a wonderful bake sale, so you can also feed your sweet tooth also.
And these craft items are authentic, obviously, you know.
Yes. There are things that, like I say, you're not going to find anyplace else. It's not like going to a craft show, which is also very nice, but these are things that are made. And when you were asking, and Phil and Father Dan were describing the conditions there, I just remember visiting a home where a lady was making placemats for us that we were going to bring back to sell. And the home had some electricity. There were a couple rooms that had like the one light bulb hanging down from the center of the ceiling, but they were quite dark. And so the home that was like several buildings built around maybe a rectangle, and then there was this central court area where the children played and a lot of the cooking goes on. And that's where the women work, outside, so that they have the sunlight to see, because the lighting inside those buildings is not good enough to do close work like these kind of weaving, embroidery, craft. So they have a short period of time when they can work, when it's daylight, you know. So when you look at these items, we think of like what we might do, crafts, what I might do in the evening when I sit down to watch television, but I have lights in my house, you know, these people don't. So they're, when I look at their items, I try to remember how they were made, you know. It's a different that's a different world.
They have access to medical care. When Gretchen's talking about doing this close work, I'm thinking of bifocals and stuff like that to do some of this elaborate embroidery.
Yes. There's a hospital there, as I mentioned before. Interestingly, it was started by a woman from Pittsburgh. Hmm. Her name was Sarah Mertes. She moved to Corpus Christi, Texas, and it became known as Clinica Corpus Christi. But as God would have coincidences go, her great-nephew, Father Gisler, became pastor at Holy Sep and came in saying, you know, I'm kind of favorably disposed toward missions. My great-aunt started one, and it took us about 30 seconds to figure out that she started the mission that his parish was serving. So that was a great story.
You handed me a picture here, Phil, of Blessed Stanley Rother, is that his name?
Blessed Stanley Rother, Father Stanley Rother, the blessed part means that he has been beatified. That is one step short of being a saint, and I believe he's on his way to sainthood.
Who is he?
He was a priest from Oklahoma City who answered a call from John 23 originally for priests to offer to serve in parishes in countries where there weren't enough priests. I mentioned earlier that the Catholic Church was, well, it was ostracized, it was frowned upon, and so there were a lot of open parishes in Guatemala, and Father Stan volunteered to serve there in Santiago Atitlan, sits right on that beautiful lake Atitlan. Here's the scoop. In 1961, a civil war started, and the idea was to return the land to the indigenous. Sounds like a swell idea, I guess, but it turns out wars are really bad things. So in a country that had 4.5 million at the start of the war, 200,000, actually research number, died. Wow. One of the people who died was Father Stan Rother.
Was he murdered?
He was murdered. He is known as the shepherd who would not run because he found he was on a death list. And when you're on a death list in Guatemala, that 36-year civil war, death does not come quickly. You're tortured trying to get more names out of you and so forth and so on. He knew what was in store for him. And he, with his associate pastor who was indigenous, left for the U.S. And while he was back home in Oklahoma City, he couldn't stand it because, you see, his town was suffering greatly. Many of his parishioners, all of his catechists were targets for murder. I think they lost 100 people at different times. You'd lose them in 5, 10, 20 at a time. Mm. He requested permission from the Archbishop of Oklahoma City and from the Bishop of Sololá in Guatemala to return. He returned to Guatemala on Holy Week of 1981. He lasted until the 28th of July, 1981, when he too became a victim. And his end came about in the following way. He, too, was taken, tortured, murdered, and the body returned to the missions there in Santiago Atitlan, where his body was discovered by the Carmelite sisters who were serving there with him. We have the pleasure of knowing two of the nine women who were serving there at the time, because they also have a mission in Putson, and we've gotten to know them over the years. In the history, in the entire history of the Catholic Church in the United States, there's exactly one priest who is an official martyr of the Catholic Church. It's Stan.
Sure, if I could add to that, he did some amazing things for the people down there. We talked a little before about Quechical being a local Mayan dialect. Mm-hmm. Over there, their local Mayan dialect was Zapotec, and it didn't have a written form. He helped them to have an alphabet for that and translated the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and perhaps part of the New Testament, so they could read it in their own language and have it read to them in their own language of Zapotec instead of Spanish. So you can tell that his people loved him. You could see some beautiful pictures of that even on the front of the book, The Shepherd Cannot Run, which is a collection of the letters from the end, the last year of his life. Very loved by his parishioners. And so whenever the representative from the U.S. came to take back his body, since it was the body of a U.S. citizen, the parishioners stood there at the church, at this beautiful church on the lake, and they wouldn't let him through until a compromise was made. And the compromise was that his body could be buried in the United States in Oklahoma City, in that diocese, but his heart would remain there in the Church of Santiago Atitlan. Mm. And so it remains to this day. Another fun fact that gets me pretty excited is there has been no native-born American male citizen saint yet canonized in the U.S. The women have us beat by over 100 years, St. Elizabeth Ann Seton, a number of saints from our past. But we've had missionaries, we've had people from other countries come in, but no native-born American male saint has been canonized yet. There's about six or seven in the running that I'm aware of, perhaps a few more that I'm not. But Father Stan, just being beatified last October, I believe, in Oklahoma City, is pretty exciting. And who knows, he may be the first American-born male saint citizen.
It's interesting. I've never heard his name before. I, you know, if you would ask me about a priest murdered in Central America, I would have said Oscar Romero. But I had not heard of Stanley Rother.
Yeah, we know hipsters are on things before they're cool. Father, or Phil, rather, Dr. Phil, was on this a long time ago, but recently, at least in the Catholic subculture, he's becoming a big hit. He's been getting more and more known, especially amongst the young people and on the Facebook groups and things like that, especially with all the ties into these themes that we have in our culture of Central America, of the poor, of injustice, and now with the immigration theme being up so often, he ties into a lot of contemporary issues in his service to the people of God.
Was he a an order priest? Does anybody
know? No, he was diocesan. So he studied for that diocese in Oklahoma City, archdiocese there, studied at Mount St. Mary's in Emmitsburg, not too far away, so somewhat local connection. Yeah, he went down there as part of a diocesan group.
This color picture of him, I was just wondering what he was wearing. It kind of like a habit there, but maybe it just was some vestments. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I don't know if that's a scarf or it's one of those Central American stoles, a little different style than what we have here in the U.S.
A little bit different, yeah. Yeah. The Franciscan nuns at the school and the orphanage, do they wear traditional habits, Phil?
Oh, yes, they do. And gosh, I've gotten to know a lot of them over the years, you know, 25 years at the mm-hmm. missions. Last year, for the ordination of Father Dan, we invited some of the nuns who had been superioras, heads of communities there in Patsun, up to participate in the event. And we were lucky enough to have them, and I really need to thank in this public way Bishop Zubik, who received these women so, so warmly, gave them an hour the day before he had back surgery. Mm. And if he could have given more time, he would. He got so excited, as did they. It was a wonderful event. Yeah, they're always in habit. And they really are a model for me and for many others. In fact, they are the reason I wanted to get people like the Oakland Catholic Girls involved in the missions, because living a faithful life, living vocations as women, has had a huge effect on the world. It had a huge effect here, and it's something that our culture is sadly losing.
The Franciscan habits are usually brown, aren't they? Am I remembering that correctly? Mm-hmm.
Yep. Yeah, brown, dark brown.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, coffee-colored, and And so are the women. So it works out really well. There's no color clash there.
It works well in the coffee country in Guatemala, too.
Right? Yeah, I mean, what's not to like? Mountains, beautiful, beautiful scenery. But it most beautiful, most violent place I know. It's contradictions, great place to have worked, and it's a great, great thing for people to support.
Do you ever fear as an American, Father Dan, when you're down there? Do you fear for your personal safety?
I'm definitely aware. I spent 4 years of my formation at Catholic U in D.C., so I'm no stranger to danger here. You got to be aware of what's around you. But fortunately, haven't had anything directly threaten me. Probably the closest was we were taking a shortcut through the capital city, and probably a good maybe 30, 40 feet away, we saw someone pull a gun out on someone else. And he made a point of people seeing that he had a gun. So that was pretty intense. That made your heart race pretty good, but he wasn't looking to target the random traffic. He was in a market looking to target a person particularly, and we kept moving along.
Do you speak Spanish or Cachacol, Father Dan?
No Cachacol, but I speak enough Spanish to get by. I just had the Spanish Mass at St. Paul's yesterday, the 2 o'clock once a month Spanish Mass there.
Mm-hmm. What about you, Phil? You're probably pretty fluent as many times as you've been down there.
Oh, there have been times in my life when I was pretty fluent, but I only really use it for the week that I'm there each year now. I do read and pray in Spanish, but my spoken Spanish isn't so hot, although I will tell you, my last radio interview was in Costa Rica in Spanish.
And, oh, wow.
And
wow.
At the time, I was able to do it.
That's terrific.
He supplements pretty well with his hand motions to get his point across and be quite humorous. Let me add about the sisters, too. It's beautiful that they're in habit, but I think it's most beautiful their hearts. And they're so joyful and have such a heart for service in a tough environment, but they also are so humorous. They love making jokes. They love pretending different things. Like in Spanish, cuchara is a spoon, and cucaracha, of course, is a cockroach. So the one was setting the table, and she's like, un cucaracha para ti. And then he's like, no, es un cuchara. Ah, un cucaracha para ti. So just little silly, innocent jokes, but wow, really help to create a bond and to make you feel welcome and loved while you're there.
It's funny, much-loved Mother Teresa always seemed to have a little smile on her face when you saw a picture of her, too. Yeah. Listen, a quick break to check lottery numbers, and then I want to go over with Gretchen the details of the Fair Trade event, because I'm sure a lot of our listeners will want to help out in a small way what we've been talking about here. So we'll be back right after this.
Midday lottery numbers for you today. The pick 2 is 6969, pick 3 605, pick 4 1119, pick 5 67888. The wild ball for each of those is 8. The treasure hunt 2, 8, 11, 23, and 29. Estimated jackpot for tomorrow's treasure hunt is $10,000.
Nearly 80% of adults in the United States experience neck and back pain at some point in their lives, ranging from mild to traumatic. The specialists at Tri-Rivers Musculoskeletal Centers diagnose and treat back pain with conservative options and can offer advanced surgical procedures when needed. To learn more, visit TriRiversMSK.com or call 1-877-874-7483. Tri-Rivers Musculoskeletal Centers, partnering with the Butler community for more than 20 years.
Handling grief is tough and lonely. After the loss of a loved one, who can really understand how you feel, how grief affects your life every single day? Well, Thompson Miller Funeral Home in Butler offers a unique, sensitive program called Someone's Caring. It's meticulously designed to help ease your emotional pain and help you fill in the gaps when you're lonely. Men and women are invited to attend. Yes, men too are realizing it's okay to express their feelings in a small group setting. Over the last 20 years, we've helped so many people work through their grief. We have 5 programs: a grief support group for those who have lost a loved one, for survivors of a suicide, for bereaved parents, for those who have lost a pet, and individual sessions. Our own trained and bereavement specialist, Robin S. Miller, conducts each session personally. Call us at Thompson Miller, 724-287-3706, 287-3706. We can help. Thompson Miller Funeral Home at the corner of East North and McCain Streets in downtown Butler. Thompson Miller, time-honored excellence.
Our time has flown by here. I want to go over the details of the Fair Trade Sale coming up Saturday, November 10th. Gretchen Carreri, give us the particulars on that again.
Okay, so this Fair Trade Sale will be held at Holy Sepulchre School Hall, which is down Route 8, about 12 miles south of Butler. You'll see the electronic billboard that will direct you into the parking lot if you're not familiar with that area. If you get to Star Lumber, you went too far, so turn around, come back. The sale starts at 9 in the morning, goes until 6 p.m. We will have five different vendors there, all kinds of crafts from around the world, jewelry, Christmas items, housewares, coffee, tea, soups, chocolates, and a huge bake sale. And one thing I should mention also,